You're listening to This Month in HIV, the Body's monthly podcast discussion about the latest, most important developments in HIV. For more information on this podcast, including a full transcript, visit us on the web at www.thebody.com/HIVmonth.
This is Bonnie Goldman, editorial director of The Body, and I'd like to welcome you to This Month in HIV. Today, we'll be looking at Women in HIV, State of the Art, 2007. HIV has become the third most deadly disease for women in the United States, behind only cancer and heart disease, and is the leading cause of death for young African-American women. A number of factors make women especially vulnerable to HIV. Gender inequality makes it difficult for women to practice safer sex in heterosexual relationships. Even in the U.S., many women cannot convince a man to put on a condom. At the same time, biological factors make women as much as 8 times more likely than men to get HIV during unprotected heterosexual sex. Globally now, women account for nearly half of all people living with HIV, and many aren't getting the support they need. Studies have also shown that many HIV-positive women are less likely to see a doctor for their HIV, and if they do see a doctor, are less likely than men to continue in care. All of this makes them more likely to die of HIV disease than HIV-positive men. What information can help women with HIV live normal, healthy lives? We asked two women, one an HIV specialist and another an HIV-positive treatment educator, what they thought positive women should know in 2007. Dr. Marge Cohn is a senior physician at Stroger Hospital in Chicago and has been the director of women's HIV research since 2000. She founded the Women and Children HIV program at Stroger Hospital, which serves more than 1,200 women, partners, and children affected by HIV. Dr. Cohn is a leading HIV researcher. She's a principal investigator in the largest ongoing study investigating the impact of HIV on women. She has authored dozens of publications on women and HIV and is the recipient of numerous awards. Kathy Olafs is an activist, treatment educator, writer, and public speaker who has been living with HIV since 1995. In her work as the education director at the Center for Health Justice in Los Angeles, Kathy leads a team of health educators who work directly with HIV-positive and at-risk individuals in the local jails. Outside of her work in incarceration, Kathy is a co-founder and current president of the Board of Directors of the AIDS Treatment Activist Coalition, a national group of new and veteran AIDS activists working to improve research and access to care for people with HIV.
Welcome to This Month in HIV. Dr. Cohn, I guess I'm going to ask you first. What do you think is the most important thing that women with HIV should know?
It was very hard to figure out the list of what is useful to get across to someone basically during their first visit, what they're most worried about. I think what women are most worried about is how long am I going to live and am I going to make it? So that's sort of, I think, number one, but I try to sort of get to that by going through a lot of other things. And I think a very important thing is how women and men do pretty well right now with HIV, and to be very encouraging and get to the issue of where are they getting support from now. And that gets me to the concept of disclosure and are people supporting the patient? Who has she told? Who does she feel will be there for her? Who could advocate for her in the many difficult situations she might find herself in terms of medical issues or other issues? And I think it's important to encourage people, if possible, to disclose to someone and to seek as much support as they can.
Who's a likely person that you find?
Many of the women that I see disclose to a friend. Some disclose to a sister. The mother issue is sort of mixed. Some do and some don't. And the issue of partners who have told who they know might be infected and they've communicated with is sort of out there. But the biggest difficulty, I think, is thinking about disclosing to new partners. Uh-huh. And also disclosing to children. In my experience, you know, there's a certain age and a certain sort of time in the family when that happens. And, you know, it's 2007 right now, and many, many women disclose to many people. I have definitely, I still have patients who've disclosed to no one but their partner. But that's very rare. I think women are disclosing to a group around them that will provide support for them for the most part.
Do you think there's a mind-body kind of angle to this, in that if you don't disclose to anybody, that it's maybe too stressful and it's a good idea?
I think there is something that, you know, if you don't have to think about it, you don't have to think about it. And you don't have to be reminded. But I find that most people get a lot of help and support if others know.
Mm-hmm. Kathy, what's your take on this?
You know what, I completely agree. There's just one thing I would add, you know, before I think a woman can get to the point where she's comfortable and confident in disclosing, a good understanding of the basics of the disease, because what usually happens, at least in my experience as being a positive woman and having had to disclose to many people over 10 years now living with the virus, you know, a lot of times you have to educate people about the disease. I remember the first time I told my mom, immediately she thought, oh my God, my daughter's going to die. And so, you know, I had to explain, well, you know, not necessarily. There's some medications out there. This was, you know, 10 years ago now. So I think it's important for women to be confident in what they're going to disclose, because a lot of times it's very easy to make mistakes during disclosure, which can then kind of push a woman back into the closet about her status, depending on how whatever she's disclosed has been received by the other party and what their reaction has been. So I think counseling is helpful. And, you know, a lot of times in support groups, there's, you know, they have discussions about how to disclose, when to disclose, you know, who do you need to tell?
What if you're not in a big city? And I mean, how would you find one of these groups?
You know, the biggest, probably the biggest piece of advice I can give to any woman out there, if she doesn't already know how to use a computer and the internet, is to learn. There's so much information and online support available for people that live in rural settings. And even, you know, getting online, you can find places that you can, you know, send an email to, and they'll send you their newsletter. And there's a lot of ways to stay connected if you don't live in a big city that has, you know, kind of established support organizations for people with HIV.
Mm-hmm. So I'm sort of surprised that disclosure is the number one thing and not medical things.
It always used to be on people's minds, and it's still on people's minds. So, you know, but I, in terms of what I find is an important thing to sort of get to in order to establish, I think, a partnership with a patient, which it's part of what I think we're talking about here, you sort of have to have a sense of if this woman is sort of in it alone, who else is there, to really get a sense of the vulnerabilities that are there that HIV is on top of and or that HIV is causing. So, you know, I totally agree that the way to establish that is for the woman to have a really, you know, best understanding she can of the disease and all the other things on my list that I could, you know, start going through. But basically, to understand how HIV affects someone and what the usual prognosis is and how heart therapy is extremely effective right now, and how well most people are doing who are being diagnosed now and going on therapy if it's indicated. So I think it's sort of related to prognosis for me. People are, I think, scared and not knowledgeable and want to learn more. And I think they want to be able to not just know it for themselves, but to share it if possible and if encouraged and supported to do that with others, so that they're going through this major life issue not alone.
Mm-hmm. What was your number two on your list?
Well, you know, it was hard to make a really good list that didn't just act like one whole thing with lots of little lines coming out of it. But I think the issue of understanding HIV and knowing how it affects many parts of your body is very important. And I think to sort of engage a patient. I mean, my sense of one of the best ways to do HIV care is sort of in an integrated model where a woman feels that this provider or the setting she's in receiving her care as much as possible attends to all of her medical and psychosocial problems, or at least that they can be named, articulated, and then addressed in some fashion. You know, I think a shorthand for that is know your numbers. You know, there's certain things that people with HIV should really know and understand the meaning of.
Meaning know your CD4 count.
Know your CD4 count, know your viral load, know what cutoffs mean, not so that you're dreading a cutoff, but that you understand a context of continuum and you understand what you could best do at each of those points to live well and you know, as well as very well. I mean, that's the point, I think.
So, Kathy, this is sort of what you mentioned, you know.
Yeah, well, my number one was actually, it's sort of interrelated, and it's really hard to put this list in kind of a linear, like, you
right.
know, 1, 2, 3, because I think women move through their own personal priorities about what's important at different times in their life with HIV. I mean, it shifts. But, you know, for me, as I stated earlier, a really good knowledge of the basics, which includes, like, why is it important to know my CD4 and viral load count? Why is it important to know the names of the medications that I'm on? You know, I still, myself and other advocates, you know, we work with people who still cannot articulate, you know, the names of the meds they're on, not even the brand name, the, you know, drug name, either one. And that's troubling. I think it's very important for people to at least be able to state to a physician or a medical provider, you know, what they're taking. So for my list, having a really good understanding of the basics is important, but it's not very it's not an easy process to get there.
Do you think a lot of women avoid it either because it's sort of, they feel it's depressing to, like, learn more about the disease?
No, actually, you know, I can only relate this to my own experience personally, but, you know, not having a medical background when I became HIV positive, not really understanding much about the immune system, you know, having not had high school biology or any of that, I was shocked. I felt like, wow, this is too much information. I'll never be able to understand it. The words are too big. You know, and it took a lot of time and it took a lot of effort and motivation on my part and on the part of other people that were around me in my life to help me get to the point where I wanted to understand this information and I wasn't afraid to understand it. But I think a lot of people are intimidated when they first get diagnosed because, you know, all of a sudden all these words that are often very foreign, you know, and are being thrown at you and you're, you know, making these decisions and you really don't understand, you know, why, you know, the doctor says, well, I can put you on this med or that med, which one do you want to go on? And, you know, a lot of times we feel helpless. So that's why I would really encourage women to use whatever resources are at their disposal to become educated. And it's like I said, it's not a quick overnight process. And as long as there's not an expectation for it to be an overnight process, I think, you know, women can be very successful in understanding this information.
And do you think there's something that they should be particularly reading? Is there a book that you read that you thought was very interesting or a website that you went to that really helped you?
You know, there are some great websites out there. Not to toot your horn necessarily, Bonnie, but The Body is a terrific resource for people with HIV. So is The Well Project for Women. It's Dawn Averett's website. Dawn Averett is a longtime AIDS advocate, a woman living with HIV. There are several women's organizations that have some websites. I know World out in Oakland, which I'm associated with, has a website that has information available on it. So I think there are lots of resources where people can, you know, access and begin to get some of this information. And then there used to be some great booklets out about women and treatment. ACREA also has a treatment issues for women booklet.
So there's a plenty of stuff available then.
Yeah.
So I guess let's go down our list more quickly because we're going to be running out of time soon. Dr. Cohn, what else do you have on your list?
I think that understanding what one needs to do to sort of just keep generally healthy in the context of HIV is important.
What
I mean, people should be tested for hepatitis A, B, and C, and if they are not currently immune, they should get immunized against hepatitis A and hepatitis B. You should get a pneumococcal vaccine, which many people should get, not just HIV-infected people, but people who smoke, people who are a little older, or have some other chronic diseases, in order to prevent pneumococcal pneumonia. And then you should get which you only have to get, say, every 5 to 10 years, that shot. But a flu vaccine people should get every year. And these are just sort of things that are part of providing the best care that should be available to someone, and hopefully are in most settings, but sometimes things get hectic and people forget. So if a woman sort of knew that, she would be on top of it herself. Getting a pap smear, a little bit more often in the beginning, but then standard with usual guidelines for any woman is very important. HIV does absolutely impact a woman's gynecological state, such that if there is human papillomavirus, HPV, the HIV virus acts sort of synergistically and creates abnormalities that we call dysplasia, that are abnormal pap smears, which most often don't lead to cancer, but can. And we certainly err on the side of detecting these abnormalities through pap smears. So abnormal pap smears should be followed up very well with a colposcopy, and that sort of gynecological care should be very available. Now, the good news is that with antiretroviral therapy, we're seeing a real reduction in these, in the progression of these abnormalities in the cervix in women with HIV. So we're sort of, with the more effective treatment of women with HIV, less of the gynecological problems are probably going to be less of a problem for women. But over time, and still many women will have HPV, it's really important to take care of those things. I also think there's this sort of general, you're not just a woman with HIV, you're a woman who has sort of all these other parts to her body and all these other possibilities for diseases, and making sure you and your provider can sort of go through those is very important. So that we know hepatitis C is an important virus that is prevalent in women with HIV, especially if there's been a use of injection drugs in the past. And that's a very important disease that has to be treated, basically. So it's that all the other diseases that impact women who have HIV have to be identified and well treated. Another important one is depression, which has been shown to decrease both the quality of life and the quantity of life. You know, decreased survival in women with HIV should be identified and addressed. So I think sort of that, both from a general health standpoint to a specific health point, those things are very important. And I think a whole other area that's critical for women is where are they at in terms of reproduction, and do they want to have prevent pregnancies, or do they want to have pregnancies? And then on the other part of the continuum, how are they doing with menopause? That those are all areas that in some situations we know a lot about, and it would be really important to share that information as much as possible and for women to make sure they have whatever resources are available to sort of make good decisions about what they want to do. And that's a really important area that I think most women who are making choices about having children or not having children really want a lot of information.
Wow. So that's a long list. So Kathy, I wondered if you can talk to the first part of what Dr. Cohn said, which is some of the tests that women with HIV should be getting on a regular basis, like, and some of the vaccines that they should be getting. Did you have anything else on your list? I mean, the flu vaccine, you know, make sure that they're tested for hepatitis.
Well, we know that the HPV vaccine is available, although, you know, I would imagine that most women who are already HIV infected have probably been exposed to HPV at some point in their life, so we're not really sure how effective that vaccine would be. However, there are increasing reports of women coming up with anal cancers associated with HPV infection. You know, and as women, you know, we grow up learning to wipe front to back, and it's if a woman has HPV, that can very easily be transmitted to the anal area. So I think it's important for women to be screened for anal cancers as well.
So they should get an anal pap smear?
Exactly. And, you know, a lot of women would probably be embarrassed to ask their provider for an anal pap, but I think it's really, really important because I know there was some reports at CROI this year, the Retrovirus Conference, showing that cancers, non-HIV-associated cancers, are actually increasing in people with HIV, including anal cancers. So I think it's important for women to be screened for that. Whether or not they've ever had anal sex, that's not necessarily an issue.
Mm-hmm. Where would one find a HIV-experienced gynecological, you know, care clinic or something?
I think, you know, you can ask around in your community. I think it's important to interview the physician who's going to be treating you to ask what is their experience. Or, you know, are they familiar, affiliated with any one of the HIV medical associations? You know, do they keep up on the latest information? Do they attend the conferences?
Do HIV specialists refer? Are they very well connected with, you know, gynecological care that is experienced with HIV?
Yeah, no, that's been my experience whenever I've needed gynecological care. My treating physician usually will refer me to someone who they're familiar with that's also familiar with treating HIV, because I think it's crucial.
I think this is an important area for this partnership, because if a woman is not clear that gynecological issues are important in women with HIV, if that's sort of like not knowledge in her head, mm-hmm. and the HIV provider sort of going through all their stuff and not attending to that, then they're going to miss a very important area. And if the provider if the patient is not going to a gynecologist besides the HIV provider, then she won't have an opportunity to sort of get a pap smear, discuss these issues, ensure that these issues are addressed. So I think it's sort of, you know, sometimes some groups have thought about sort of a card for women with HIV, which are the things that they have to sort of check off on the list to make sure they're getting the best care. And I think ensuring, starting with getting a pap smear that someone looks at, that someone understands that in the context of HIV, is a good starting point for that.
Wow. Yeah, very important point. I think that is it in the guidelines now, particular care for women with HIV?
Yes.
Sometimes
that, you know, I think it's very important. Someone could say, oh, make sure you get one, because it's sort of part, you know, I'm not sure every HIV physician is doing gynecological exams. Some are, and that's good. Some will refer and then have someone else do it. But it is an issue for women that women have to sort of name as an issue that should be addressed, just as contraception, just as having children, et cetera.
Right. Dr. Cohn, I had one more question. You mentioned hepatitis C, and I think there's a lot of misconceptions about this. A lot of women think that they've already been tested for it. Is that they think, well, I got tested for HIV and other STDs, so I must have gotten that. Like, why do I, you know, is that, or they already got their initial care for HIV. So they think, well, they probably looked if I had that too.
Again, this is a routine expected guideline that people with HIV should have their status in terms of hepatitis A, B, and C checked to know whether are immune or to A and B, or have been infected at some point with hepatitis C and would require further investigations. A lot of people clear hepatitis C, a lot of people it's not a problem, but increasingly it's a very important disease entity for women and men with HIV to understand, to take seriously. If people are living longer with HIV, therefore we don't want them to die from other causes, and we want them to get the best treatment for other diseases that they have now that their HIV is under significant control. So, you know, I think we sort of, between patients going to different providers, a poor healthcare information system, a lack of a national healthcare program, healthcare is not as good as it should be. So I think people understanding and really having a sort of a list in their heads of what the diseases are that they have to make sure they have been evaluated for is the best way to ensure this.
Mm-hmm. So you would recommend that if a woman doesn't know if she's been tested,
she should find out. Okay. Right. I definitely would suggest that she should
go with a checklist
know.
And say,
exactly.
Hello.
I think that's the best way, but, you know, we don't sort of want to, I mean, in general, patients in whatever disease they have are, I think, feel at a disadvantage because they don't know everything. And there's a lot of, often physicians and patients sort of don't partner to deal with a disease. That's what we most need to make HIV and every other medical problem sort of get the best resolutions. We need patients and partners, patients and doctors partnering. And sometimes the best way to do that is for patients to remind doctors, and sometimes it's for doctors to ensure that they have all this available information so that they're reminded to do the right thing all the time. I think both working together is really the best way to make that happen.
Mm-hmm. So, Kathy, do you remind your doctor to do things that...
Actually, I'm very lucky. I have a great physician. She's one of the top female HIV physicians in the country. So I feel blessed in that, quite often we have some very interesting discussions about treatment, but, I haven't ever found myself needing to remind her. It's usually quite the opposite. You know, she'll remind me it's time for your PAP or something like that. But we have a great relationship, and I think that's crucial as well, that you have open lines of communication with your physician. And if you feel at all uncomfortable with the physician that you're seeing, it is within your right to request to be seen by a different doctor.
Mm-hmm. Were you always so brave?
You know, it came with time. And listening to other women and taking the advice of other people, to stand up for myself and stand up for my health.
Mm-hmm. How did you find your doctor?
Well, I ended up at the clinic where I'm at right now through the form of health insurance that I have. But I actually saw my doctor's name in print long before that, in related to HIV research studies. For women.
So you picked a researcher who was also treating.
Yeah. Well, I got lucky when I went to the clinic. I requested to see her and she was available. So
that's great.
I'm pleased about that.
Uh-huh. So
I haven't ever really had a bad experience with a physician.
Uh-huh.
I've had some uncomfortable experiences with some physicians over the years, but never a really bad experience. I think most physicians that are in work truly, truly care about what they're doing, because there's many different opportunities that they could be involved with as far as medical care. And if they've chosen to be involved with HIV, I feel like there's an extra special commitment there.
Uh-huh. Dr. Cohen, in your previous answer, you mentioned talking about women who want to have a baby, and
mm-hmm.
And could you go into that a little bit? And what if a woman is thinking about that? What kind of things should she take into consideration?
Well, I think it should be brought on the table, and a woman should feel empowered to have that discussion. And we want to ensure that she goes about that in the healthiest way for her and everybody else involved. So I think I think that would require a very sympathetic and knowledgeable OB team that is committed to using medications and treating her throughout the entire pregnancy and monitoring well. and following at labor and delivery and postpartum. But I think the idea that I was referring to is that this is a serious desire on many women's part, and it should be met. And women all over who are infected with HIV, who know they're infected with HIV, are becoming pregnant, are doing well during their pregnancy. We know that pregnancy doesn't increase disease progression of HIV, and it's sort of pretty much all good news for women who are doing well on antiretrovirals or who are early in the course of illness to proceed appropriately to have a child. If they are on certain medications, we discourage the use of efavirenz or Systeva in women who are thinking about getting pregnant. And we would recommend different medications, but there is a whole host, and there are good choices and great results for in our country for women who are HIV infected, who know it, and who desire to have a child. And I just think it's a really important issue to state, because I think partly for what's going on in the rest of the world and partly what's been the history of HIV care in women, it's not always been true. Women more often discriminated against if they wanted to have children. They weren't taken seriously. It wasn't thought appropriate, and that's really changed, and it should continue to change so that women can have the right to the reproductive choices that they want.
Would you say this is true for women at any CD4 count, or is there some cutoff point?
I think a woman makes the decision, basically. I've seen women at every CD4 count have children. Either sometimes they weren't exact choices being made. Things just sort of happened. But right now, we have potential to have women have to improve their CD4 count. So therefore, there can be a discussion of, well, maybe it would be better for your situation, for you, and for what you want to do in the future, to see how you respond to heart therapy, to antiretroviral therapy. And when we see you're doing well, that would be a better opportunity to think about getting pregnant. But I mean, to make sure that it's a discussable point and that you feel comfortable talking about it with the provider, and the provider feels comfortable talking about it with you. Otherwise, you're going to get mixed messages.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I think you hit on a really important point about making sure that you discuss your desire to get pregnant with your physician, hopefully prior to actually becoming pregnant, because there's a lot of things that women can do to bolster their health prior to actually achieving a pregnancy, which will help support a healthy pregnancy and a healthy outcome. So, whenever possible, let your physician know that you're considering this. And, there's vitamins that you can take. And, mm-hmm. We know that it's very important for a woman to have a low viral load going into a pregnancy, as well as a low viral load during pregnancy and delivery. So, again, whenever possible, it's great to plan a pregnancy. And it's such fabulous news for women living with HIV, at least in the developed world, that we can have that option now, and it's, relatively safe.
Does a woman have to be on treatment?
Yes, when she's pregnant.
Uh-huh.
We recommend it, actually, regardless of her CD4 count, to reduce transmission the most. It's, of course, always the woman's choice what she wants to do. But the recommendation is not only to reduce the viral load and increase CD4, but really also the medications themselves for transmission that occurs during pregnancy, that being on medications is believed to be quite important. I also think the issues, pregnancy is also a time to discuss other issues that are important actually during many parts of a woman's life, but cigarette smoking, alcohol, drug use, violence issues just are also important to consider for a healthier time with HIV, as well as for sure to maintain the best pregnancy.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and in terms of breastfeeding, I know there was recent news from the big HIV conference in Los Angeles about breastfeeding in the developing world. Could you talk to what this means for women in the USA?
Yeah, I think the recommendation is going to stay in our country to not for women with HIV to not breastfeed. There is an increase in HIV infection from with each month of breastfeeding. I think what we saw in the study that was done in South Africa by really wonderful people is that other issues of mortality in the developing world as well do weigh in. And breastfeeding itself for the first 6 months solely breastfeeding was the most effective way compared to formula supplementation or mixed feeding. That's not the situation we have in our country. I think I'm not convinced that our guidelines are going to change soon.
Mm-hmm. So it's the previous, whatever was recommended and is being recommended now, nothing should change as a result of that conference.
Yeah, no, I agree that there were clear indications. There are issues in some of the countries and the studies, you know, where poor sanitation, you know, problems with unclean water to mm-hmm. mix the formula. So, mm-hmm. You know, we don't have those issues here. And I think there are other options for women in the U.S. who may want to be able to provide, you know, breast milk to their infant. There are programs, you know, where women can share breast milk. So maybe you can, you know, if you have the resources, you can obtain breast milk through one of those sources rather than putting your child at risk if you're HIV positive.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, related to pregnancy and women with HIV, what if you don't want to get pregnant? What are the contraceptives that you can use if you're on treatment? Doctor?
I think that the information on the difficulties related to birth control with a hormonal contraception and in women with HIV is hard to interpret in my opinion, so that really whatever regimen the woman and her provider finds to be the best for her. We have women on things that they've chosen, whether that's Depo-Provera, whether that's other approaches. The thing to, of course, remember is that anything that is contraception that prevents a woman from getting pregnant, if not a condom, will not, of course, prevent another infection with HIV. And though the data is a little unclear on that as well, I think reinfection is probably not a good thing.
So medications, you don't think, lower the effectiveness of hormonal birth control pills?
I think there's enough data out there that to know that a woman who is taking hormonal contraceptives definitely needs to have her drug levels monitored to make sure that she's not either losing effectiveness of either the contraceptive itself or the protease inhibitor or the HIV medication that she happens to be on, because I know there's a lot of data that shows either the meds impact the contraceptive or the contraceptive impacts mm-hmm. the meds. I think if a woman really does not want to take any risk of becoming pregnant, that she might consider using a second barrier method of contraception just in case. Mm-hmm. I know that there's a push for further studies to actually find out, you know, what the impact is of some of the newer medications, and even the ones that we have on hormonal contraceptives. Just, you know, this is one of the many, many mm-hmm. still unanswered questions in relation to HIV treatment for women. You know, we get little bits and pieces each year. Maybe a small study comes out with a little more information, but I think we still don't know everything we need to know.
Uh-huh. I guess continuing on the track of unanswered questions, are there any gender differences in terms of responsiveness to treatment that you've noticed? I know the studies have not, there have not been that many yet, but what do we know so far? Anything? Dr. Cohn?
Well, there are some studies that have shown that there's a greater viral rebound in women when they stop certain medications. There are some studies that show that just starting with women versus men, that women's viral load at any particular CD4 count is lower than a man's viral load at that same CD4 count. But much of what we know along those lines has not produced a clinical significance at this point. We think that the reasons for these changes, I'll get to side effects in a second, but I think we think the reasons for this might be hormonal, might be fat distribution. There's lots of really important areas to continue to investigate. We do know that certain medications women do worse on. The black box warning on nevirapine is an example for women who have CD4 counts over 250, not recommended, is one that came about because of providers and seeing women do poorly on that medication and actually have a greater reaction in terms of mitochondrial toxicity and liver disease. So there have been absolute differences, and I think I work with the study, the WISE study, Women Interagency HIV study, which is in six different cities, and we continually are concerned with looking at what medications are now being used and how women are responding to them, both in terms of metabolic abnormalities as well as other side effects, as well as in terms of how effective the medications are for those women. And I think it's an important area to continue doing work in.
You were going to mention something about side effects. Were you going to mention body shape changes?
Right. I think that there are issues there that are important in terms of lipo atrophy, in terms of fat distribution. I think it's important for, well, it's important for women and men for sure. But I think it's also very important to investigate these issues in both women and men. And women historically in the HIV epidemic have called on providers and researchers to like pay attention to them in these regards as new medications came on, and I think that's very, very important to do.
Mm-hmm. Have you noticed difference in terms of lipoatrophy with women? I mean, I know that the facial wasting seems to be a lot less common in women than in men with HIV. Have you seen that kind of thing?
No, we absolutely see facial wasting, and we see mainly reductions in fat, which is what you're referring to. And actually, many of the studies show that that's true in men as well as in women. So I think we're learning a great deal. I mean, and we're trying to make people be on regimens that reduce those side effects as much as possible. And I think that's really important.
So anything, any idea of what a woman can do if she has very thinning legs and a bloating stomach, for instance? That's a common complaint I hear.
It's very hard. If sometimes some of the regimens, even if you change them, the side effects continue. Some of my patients have felt that certain exercise regimens and dietary changes have been very helpful. But it's a serious struggle, I think, to deal with what does come with therapy at the moment.
Kathy?
Right. Well, there are some other options as far as things that will help build muscle mass, but they're usually quite expensive, mm-hmm. and sometimes require a physician that's very creative in their ability to demonstrate the need for it in order for it to be covered by some insurances.
You mean growth hormone? Or?
Yeah, human growth hormone and things like that. I think there's a little bit of data that shows that may help with some of the at least the fat accumulation. Most of my experience with women and in what I've read and also what I've seen is women more commonly have fat accumulation around the belly and in the breast area. and mm-hmm. sometimes around the face to some extent, and then they'll have fat loss in the arms and the legs and the butt.
That's what our study
can be
show.
Very disturbing. And you know, I never really want to underplay that. I think it can definitely impact a woman's life very negatively. You know, if she goes from being normal to having this, you know, being an egg on sticks, as it's commonly referred to. You know, and I wish that there were some options that could help reverse that. You know, I have some friends that have experienced really terrific body shape changes, and you know, they've learned to cope with it, but still, it changes things for them emotionally.
But it seems to be the current price of treatment.
And for some treatments, I think things are looking up. Mm-hmm. I really feel confident about that. I think some of the medications that were more commonly associated with body shape changes are in less use now, and I think there are better options out there now that show less indication of these changes, although currently all HIV medications are associated with some body shape changes and lipid changes and other side effects.
So I don't know, my next question, I don't know if you have this on your list, but I know a lot of women have it in their mind, and that is vitamin supplementation, or the idea that if they just ate well and took a lot of vitamins, you know, there's stuff out on the web that says, you'll do fine. You know, take a lot of, I don't know, you know, CoQ10 and vitamin D and a whole bunch of other stuff. What would you say, Dr. Cohn, to a woman who's thinking of not taking antiretroviral treatment, as it's called, or HIV treatment, because of the threat of body shape changes, or because they're afraid of the toxicities, or the, you know, they say it's a little toxic, et cetera. What do you say to a woman like that?
Well, it does happen, and what I do say is patiently the first many times, and then I have an impatient character, so it comes out after a while that, you know, it's a question of different modalities. It would be really, really inappropriate if you're at a certain stage of HIV illness to not use antiretroviral therapy to prolong to prevent bad infections and to develop AIDS. It would be really an inappropriate response to this point in the disease. That I actually recommend vitamins in usual doses and not in mega doses. I don't mind if people take whatever vitamins they want. I mean, it's their choice, but it's not going to really have a tremendous effect on preventing HIV disease progression as antiretroviral therapy will. So I'm really concerned, and you know, I have several patients who fit into the description we're discussing right now, and they've not been successful when they haven't been on antiretroviral therapy when their T cells were very low. And you know, people want things to go their way, and they want to feel that they'll give it one more try of that other alternative method. And I think people should use alternative methods, but they should not use them at the expense of not using antiretroviral therapy.
Kathy?
You know, I would point back to the availability of better treatments now than we had, 5 to 7 years ago. And I never want to underestimate the importance of preserving immune function. You know, when I think about my own illness status and that, you know, I've been diagnosed for 11 years now and never been sick. And I really feel like the fact that I got into care early, not necessarily that I was on treatment, at a specific time. I think I got on treatment when I needed to. I went off treatment when I needed to, and I went back on when I needed to. And, you know, just the fact that I got into care and was, being monitored and being taken care of, I think that's really important. And I think there is a critical point. I'm not sure that we know exactly when it is yet as far as, when to initiate treatment. But I really firmly believe that the immune system, once it goes past a certain point, it may not be able to come back fully. If you can avoid going over that cliff, I think that's crucial to long-term survival with this disease. Mm-hmm. So I guess the key message is to get into care. Doesn't mean that you absolutely need to be on treatment. I think the benefits of when to start treatment still need to be evaluated. I said that wrong. The benefits of treatment are clear. When to start still needs to be evaluated. I think it's an individual choice.
So, Kathy, what do you say to somebody who says, well, I know a girl who's all she's taking is vitamins and she's fine?
I hear that all the time. You know, we're all individual and everybody copes with the disease differently and everyone's been infected with a different, strain of HIV. It is really an individual choice and an individual decision about treatment and how to pursue treatment. That's been a common thread in support groups for many years now is, so-and-so takes that medication and they have all these side effects, so I'm not going near that one. And we all know that, everyone experiences side effects differently. So we can't base our decisions about treatment on someone else's experience. We need to evaluate each decision ourselves individually and do what's right for us with all the information that we have available.
Mm-hmm. Kathy, on your current regimen, are you having side effects that are noticeable every day?
No. I take my meds once a day. I'm on a pretty common regimen. I've been on treatment regimens in the past where I had pretty severe side effects. So also having had this disease as long as I have and knowing what I know about treatment, I'm also very, very adherent because I don't want to burst this bubble. I'm doing well. I'm happy. I'm not having side effects. All I have to do is take my meds once a day, a few pills. So, I'm grateful for that. And I don't take advantage of that.
Mm-hmm. And do you take any vitamins?
I do take, kind of a multivitamin once a day. And, I try to eat right. I'm just like everybody else. I can't quite get the five a day with the vegetables. I try, though. I do the best I can, and I think that's all we can expect anybody.
Well, we're almost coming to a close. Did you have anything else, Dr. Cohen, on your list that we didn't mention yet?
I just would want to mention that it's not exactly like what you would say to a woman who's sitting in front of you, which is sort of how you're phrasing this question, but the issue of both violence and incarceration for many women with HIV is paramount. And I would just want listeners or readers to sort of have that in their consciousness as an issue that we really have to address if we're going to have the most women do the best they can with HIV, because it sort of rears its head often. Some women find themselves going back and forth in our incarceration system, and it would be really important to ensure that they have care wherever they are and are easily connected and as much as possible get helped so that that's not a continuing revolving door. And there's many women who experience issues related to violence that absolutely impact their ability to stick to a regimen, adhere to therapy. And if we don't provide sort of intensive therapeutic options for those women, we probably won't be able to address the obstacles that they're experiencing in order to take the best regimens. So I just sort of wanted to make sure in terms of issues we've addressed for women that that's included.
Meaning domestic violence? And
absolutely. Yeah.
Is it that the study that you're working on, the long-term natural study, the mm-hmm. Y study, it showed that many women, what was the percentage?
We had about 67% of the two out of three women that we follow, of the 3,000 women we follow, have had some history of violence at some point in their lives, and almost one out of three had experienced violence as a child, sexual violence as a child. So, and that sexual violence as in childhood sexual abuse was associated with a sort of continuum of violence in their lives and of behaviors that would, you know, definitely put them at risk for HIV and put them at risk for depression and post-traumatic stress and other difficulties. And then we found, not only in terms of that, but we found that women who should be on medications for HIV, for whom it's indicated, if they were had a history of violence in their lives previously, they were less likely to be taking medications. They were more likely to have stopped or never to have been started. So, I mean, I think there's a sort of assault that occurs that takes a lot of effort to recover from, and we have to be very conscious about that as providers and in support groups, et cetera.
Kathy?
Agree.
I know you have personal experience working with women who are incarcerated. Is that the kind of thing that you're seeing as well? That
absolutely. You know, it's we are the agency that I work for, Center for Health Justice. We actually go inside the Los Angeles County Jails, which is the largest jail system in the world, actually. And there's a large population of women, and we go in and we teach them about HIV, and quite frequently, and we're lucky because a couple of our staff are living with HIV, so we're able to share from that perspective with the women. You know, but a lot of times when the discussion comes to, you know, safer sex and being assertive and protecting yourself, and then frequently it comes up, you know, but, well, how can I do that? You know, I don't feel comfortable, you know, asking my partner to use a condom because this, you know, these experiences in the past where, you know, there's been violence. And, I think when we're thinking about prevention for women, we absolutely have to take the whole woman into context. And, I know that's been said in the past and become sort of a cliche, but we can't ever forget that. When we're thinking about women with HIV, we have to also think about, you know, their lives outside of their health. Just, you know, their emotional health, their mental health, their wellness, their economic status, all of this comes into play.
I once did an interview with a woman, and she said something that was very striking to me. She said, you know, you really have to love yourself to take HIV treatment. Mm-hmm. And that's so, because every day it's a positive action. You're saying, I love myself, I want to live, and you take the pill or the pills. Or twice a day, you have to say that. You have to not be conflicted. You can't be ambivalent. You have to be clear that you want to survive, that you deserve to survive, that you're worthy enough to survive, and take that pill. And I think that is kind of a problem for a lot of women, making that assertion.
Right. That's why support groups are so important, and having, you know, women, you know, both in locally, nationally, and internationally, groups that sort of allow women to say what it's like to have HIV and what they most want, so that women will feel empowered and assertive, and much as possible, you know, increase their ability to take care of themselves.
Mm-hmm. That was actually my number two. On my list was get support, keep support, and stay connected, or come back to support, because I think a lot of women, you know, that they've gotten to a point in their disease where, you know, they're managing it, maybe they're back at work, and you know, we sort of forget about how powerful it is for a newly diagnosed woman to be able to interact with a woman who's living positively with a disease for some time. So I encourage women who have maybe been out of the support group, you know, women's support network for a while, to come back in and share what they have to offer, their, you know, their positive attitude with women who are kind of going through a rough time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Kathy. Thank you, Dr. Cohn.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Thanks a lot.
You've reached the end of This Month in HIV's program. To read the transcript or let us know what you think of this program, please visit www.thebody.com/HIVmonth.